Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Yesterday, the nation marked 1 year since the mass shooting at an El Paso Walmart. 23 people were killed and 22 injured. But that statistic doesn't begin to describe the hurt that the border city and many across Texas continue to deal with since the day when a white supremacist with an assault rifle walked into that shopping center and opened fire. I spoke with El Paso U.S. Representative Veronica Escobar, who represents El Paso, about how she's dealing with the Walmart shooting 1 year later.
I filed legislation to make the El Paso Healing Garden into a national memorial. And it is a healing garden that has been dedicated by the County of El Paso to the victims and the survivors. And it's been a local effort in the center of town, several miles away from the actual site of the massacre. But I wanted to make sure that we elevate this to a national level because it really was a national tragedy, a domestic terrorist attack, not just against El Paso, but against Latino communities. Something that I felt was really important. So it was my privilege to file that bill.
It's interesting that as a national place to think about this particular shooting, but also we have so many of these shootings that if we should be following that as a way to create this mosaic of all these places to remind us that this is a national problem.
It really is a national problem. And unfortunately, there are far too many communities that have suffered just incredible trauma the way that El Paso has. You know, what does make the massacre that occurred a year ago in El Paso unique is that we weren't just at the center of the America's gun violence epidemic on that day, but we were also at the center of America's hate epidemic on that day because the killer confessed that he drove over 600 miles in order to end what he called the Hispanic invasion. He brought his AK-47 with him in order to do that. And we today, 1 year later, we are still as a country grappling with both of those monumental challenges, gun violence and racism and hatred.
After the shooting and President Trump went to El Paso, you told him you didn't want him to come, and then you refused to meet with him when he did. Have you thought any more about that? Did you think that that was the, if you had to do it again, that's how you would have handled it?
Well, there's a component of that that's missing. When I found out that he was coming to El Paso, my initial reaction was, and I still believe this, you should not come to a community that is reeling from incredible pain when you yourself have helped stoke the fires of racism and division that are burning across this country. And so I felt that he needed to be remorseful. He needed to be self-aware before stepping foot in the community. And so when we got the call, my office received a phone call from his office inviting us to participate in the motorcade when he touched down in El Paso. I knew that that day that we received that call, he had nothing on his calendar. So our response in return was, okay, before we give you an answer about whether or not we will participate in the motorcade, I want to talk to him. I want to talk to the president. I'd like a 5-minute phone call. He had already called the mayor. He had called the governor. He had called a number of other people. And so my purpose was to confront him and say, look, this is an opportunity for you to begin to help heal our country. You can be remorseful for the way that you've spoken about immigrants, about Mexicans, about people of color. This can be truly a healing moment for our nation. Don't let these deaths be in vain. That's what I wanted to tell him. But his office let us know he was simply too busy to return our call that day, even though there was nothing on his calendar. And so, of course, I was not going to participate in a motorcade as a prop. I felt that if he was going to step foot in our community, he needed to acknowledge part of what led to the kind of hate that we're seeing in this country.
So here we are a year later, and boy, has so much changed since then. Is that also part of what was going on with these reflections? Of course, I mean, it's enough to talk about what happened at Walmart, but also, you know, how we've dealt with immigration over the past 12 months and also how we're dealing with COVID and the COVID response. It is just a lot for people to think about. And when you, I read that when you got word that there was a shooting at the Walmart, you were doing at a high school, a town hall meeting, something we can't even do anymore. I mean, so much, right. We've lost so much over the last 12 months.
We really have. And, you know, I will tell you, I have been very concerned about my community, about the pain and the trauma. I've spoken with mental health experts in the community who have expressed to me that there are innumerable El Pasoans living through what they call compound trauma. So, and you listed all of the challenges that El Paso has faced. We were ground zero for the Trump administration's anti-immigrant rhetoric, for his policies, and for his attacks on vulnerable human beings. So we were there and had to bear witness to family separation. We were there when people were being held in incredibly inhumane detention holding facilities. We were there as migrants were released onto the streets by ICE with nowhere to go. You know, and we responded with goodwill, with kindness, with generosity. We took people in. We cared for the stranger, which is what we've been taught to do. And then, you know, it was months and months of that. And then the attack on El Paso, the shooting a year ago, where, you know, we were targeted according to the killer's confession, because we are a community of immigrants, because we are a Mexican-American Latino community. And then COVID hit, and we live in a state where there has been no acknowledgement that by the governor that COVID is disproportionately impacting communities of color, especially Latino communities. El Paso has been in a state that is a hot spot, and we have been one of the communities that has had the highest deaths per capita. We are 85% Latino. We have at least a quarter of our population that is uninsured because we live in a state that refuses, with a governor that refuses to expand access to health care. And so, as I've spoken with the mental health experts, they've expressed to me that all of this put together has obviously been extremely stressful and painful for El Pasoans. But, you know, I will tell you, even in the face of every single one of those challenges, whether it was the refugees arriving at our front door, or whether it was the attacker who came to do us harm, or whether it is the virus that has been decimating families and individuals, El Pasoans have remained charitable, kind, and loving through every challenge, through thick and thin. I could not be prouder to represent such a beautiful community.
The shooter walked through the front door of the Walmart with the AK-47 style assault weapon with the extended clip, something that he was able to purchase legally at the time. Now his defense attorneys are saying that the shooter may have been dealing with a mental illness. Which is what they're saying in his defense. How could someone who has been dealing with a lifelong mental illness be able to purchase a weapon like that legally?
Well, you know, I will tell you, our country has not done enough to provide care and resources for the mentally ill. We have not viewed mental health care in the same way that we view health care from the neck down, basically. You know, the brain is a part of the body, and it should be attended to with the same kind of rigor that we attend to other healthcare issues like heart disease and diabetes. And our country just has not for a very, very, very long time. And we lack the resources in even some of the biggest American cities, lack of access to therapists and psychologists and psychiatrists. And it's definitely true for communities like mine, and it's definitely true in rural communities as well.
So we have lack of access to mental health care, but we have plenty of access to weapons of war.
We have plenty of access to guns. That's absolutely right. We have some very profoundly mixed up priorities in this country, where there is more time and energy that's put into lobbying members of Congress about making sure that people can have the easiest, quickest access to absolutely any weapon that they want at any time. When we think about gun violence and where we have gotten to in this country, the fact that we have not even in the Senate been able to see them bring H.R. 8, a bill that we passed that is widely supported by Americans of all walks of life, Americans from both parties, that calls for common sense gun violence prevention. The fact that we can't even get a debate on it in the U.S. Senate, the fact that they won't even talk about the bill or bring it up, despite needless death after needless death, is a testament to the profoundly mixed up priorities of this country.
Veronica Escobar represents El Paso in Congress. She has filed a bill to turn a memorial park from the El Paso shooting into a national memorial. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. When we come back, we continue our discussion of the El Paso shooting 1 year later. You can call in with your memories and impressions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're looking back at the El Paso Walmart shooting 1 year later. After 12 months, the pain doesn't go away, but frequently the spotlight does. So what we want to do is more than just commemorate the shooting and think about what happened that day, but also what are the issues that were brought forth on that day and how were they talked about and how are they continued not to be resolved? What do we need to be thinking about when we think about El Paso shooting 1 year later? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can also email us at thesource@tpr.org, tweet at us at @TPRSource. We're joined now by Deborah Zuloaga, the CEO of the United Way of El Paso County. Deborah, welcome to The Source.
Good afternoon.
Bob Moore joins us, President and CEO of El Paso Matters. Bob Moore, good to have you.
Thanks for allowing me to be on. I appreciate it.
And also joining us is Janet Murr Morguia, the President and CEO of the Latino Civil Rights and Advocacy Organization, Unidos U.S. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you all.
Bob Moore, let me go to you first. You've been covering this. You were a Pulitzer Prize finalist for your reporting on this shooting when you were working with the Washington Post. A year later, how did El Paso, how was El Paso reacting to this?
It's a range of emotions. The anger is still there. The fear is still there in some ways, and certainly the grief is there. But the one thing that's really struck me in the past year is the resilience of the community, and the commitment not to be defined by what an outsider did to our community, and to try to reclaim control of our own narrative. As Congresswoman Escobar mentioned in the interview, this was not a one-off event. This was the continuation of a pattern demonization of Latinos, demonization of the border. And it's a pattern that unfortunately continues till today. And so I think there's a resolve in El Paso to kind of push back against that and to tell a much more complete story of our community.
Deborah Zuloaga, if you could tell me more about the fear that people have. Oh, y'all set up these resiliency centers to help survivors and the community to cope after the shooting. So talk about, I mean, what emotional trauma that people deal with, even if they weren't even at the Walmart.
So sadly, what we have learned about trauma and about situations that have happened, and as Bob mentioned and as our congressman mentioned, ours was a unique situation because it was not an individual from our community. It was an individual who literally drove 10 hours to get here to cause the pain that he caused in our community. But what we have sadly learned is what has happened in other communities. We are not the first community to go through a mass casualty event. We stood up starting in December of 2019, the El Paso United Family Resiliency Center. It is both a comprehensive case management services for individuals affected by the shooting, but also traditional therapy, counseling and therapy, and also non-traditional services that are now being offered to individuals in the community that were affected by the shooting. Because when we think of the shooting, of course, as we should, we think of the 23 individuals who sadly lost their lives and the 48 who were injured. But it goes so much deeper, and we've learned from other communities how it really does impact an entire community. So what our role is as the Family Resiliency Center is to make sure that we are providing resources for our community. And I want to also say that, you know, as the congressman mentioned, we've got a compound situation here in our community because we have been affected by three major issues within the last 18 months. So, you know, what we're really seeing are people who just want to talk. Some want to take part in some of the non-traditional therapies like yoga and writing. And some individuals want the traditional talk therapy, counseling, traditional therapies. So, and we're just getting started. And obviously, the pandemic has really changed how we were planning and anticipating providing services. So we're really having to rethink and pivot and do a lot more virtual services, and even our case management with the families and the individuals, the employees of both the Walmart and other locations around there has changed in that it has been virtual. It's more phone rather than in person. So, you know, it's not only is it this, was it going to be a difficult situation for us to assist with and to really help the community heal, it's become even more difficult in that we're doing it through a pandemic.
Deborah, do you feel like San Antonio is a majority Latino city? Many people here really, although they weren't in El Paso, hundreds of miles away, still felt a lot of connectivity to what happened there. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. You know, it's amazing. In fact, it's interesting you should say that. I was speaking to a friend of mine that was on a cruise in like South America, and they were talking to individuals from Australia, and when they said, "We're from El Paso," the first thing the people said was, "Oh my gosh, we are so sorry." I believe that this affected, and people, because of the reasoning behind this event, really was different, and certainly not making it worse, because any mass casualty event is terrible, but because it was racially motivated, it did impact everyone all over the world.
And Janet Murguia, President and CEO of Unidos U.S., Latino Civil Rights Organization, how did the fact that the shooter wrote this manifesto specifically citing his hatred for Hispanics and as a voting bloc, how did that come to play with your work in this area?
Well, obviously, as a civil rights organization, we saw this tragedy through the impact on our and its impact on our community, and it's clear that it was clearly an intersection of an act of gun violence but also an act of racism. And obviously there's policies on the gun violence front that you heard the congresswoman, who's been a tremendous champion for the area, talk about in terms of addressing the issues of gun violence and the accessibility of guns, especially assault weapons and others, to use this in such a way. But the fact is that we also saw it as an act of deadly racism. It was the largest massacre of Hispanics in modern U.S. history. And so for us, we made the connection and saw, and I wrote an op-ed in last year, a few days after this, in the New York Times, that links the shooter's manifesto to President Trump's own rhetoric. The shooter used many of the same words that President Trump had used in talking about the Latino community and talking about Hispanics and in talking about immigrants. And, you know, it's very clear that the shooter echoed the president's words. And he specifically said this shooting in his manifesto is in response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. So we have to be very vigilant in understanding that. I think for too long, it's been easy for the president and his allies to continue demonizing Latinos because they believe they never have to pay a political price for it. But I know that that is all changing. And there is a connection now, increasingly, as we see our Latino community much more mobilized and eager to engage in the election process, to make a connection between those who are trying to divide us, who are demonizing us, and looking at those who will try to unite us as a country and who see the value and the values of the Latino community as important part of this country's future. And so there will be a lot of I know, Latinos and Latinas, as we look to the future and as we look at the electoral process, and they will remember El Paso, and they'll remember in November. And so for us, it's going to be very important that we hold politicians accountable for not just their acts and their deeds, but also for their words and their rhetoric.
When you look at the manifesto that the shooter wrote, this is exactly what he was fearing, that he wrote specifically that Latinos voting as a block would power the Democrats to control the United States, and that he was citing other theories about the Great Replacement, and very much showing that he was not alone in these radical racist extremist views. But this is something that has a lot of traffic online, Janet.
Yeah, Dave, I want to be really clear. You know, I had the chance to visit El Paso about a month and a half after the tragedy. And like the work of Deborah with United Way, we're also connected to a number of community-based organizations across the country as part of our Unidos U.S. network, but many who are also working in Texas and in El Paso. And Project Bravo, the YWCA of El Paso, Centro Salud de la Fe, they showed us that the victims themselves, and I talked to a few, said that it was very clear that the shooter had a misperception, he didn't know them,
sure,
is what they said. He didn't know us.
But he knew what he had been told, so that's probably what needs to be addressed. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the El Paso shooting, the one-year commemoration. What can we learn from the shooting now that we have a little bit of perspective? We could also look back at some of the promises that were made at the time and how have they been followed up? Where are we with dealing with mass violence in America, particularly when it's targeted against particularly racial groups, whether it be be Latinos or Jewish people or all sorts of folks are being targeted, African Americans. What's happening? How is this an issue for all of us? You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We did get a caller who had to drop. Tracy, I'm a huntsman and a gun owner, but we need to have universal background checks for purchasing guns. And let's go to a caller online right now, and this is Lamar. Lamar, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, go ahead.
Hey, so I'm also a gun owner. I'm also first-generation American, and I kind of see the whole discussion as, like, from someone who, I guess, has a maybe no bias or little to no bias. Growing up, my parents were kind of anti-gun, and I grew up and became a gun owner, you know, as responsibly as I could. But I remember when I was working in Europe, and I would try to read about the American gun situation, it was just so overly politicized all the time. For the people who are gun owners, I feel like there's nowhere to go to actually discuss solutions. Like, in any other country, they have universal background checks and robust, you know, systems in place for tracking firearms. I mean, the technology is there. We could put our firearms on a national blockchain or something. Who knows? But I feel like the discussion is taken in Congress to, like, this weird absolutist place where nothing can get done, where it's either everything is legal and there's no checks on anyone, and or, you know, everyone's going to come take your gun. Like, and I feel like no one wants to look at the facts that, like, the amendment's there mm-hmm. for a reason. There's more guns than people here, and I don't know how we're ever going to get rid of all of them, but if we want to cut down or at least start to regulate this a bit, then we need to, you know, I don't know, both make compromises on both sides.
All right, Lamar, thank you for your call. I appreciate that. Janet Merguia, as the president and CEO of the Latino Civil Rights and Advocacy Organization, Unidos U.S., was there a gun policy that y'all have arrived at that you think would have, it should be an appropriate response to the El Paso shooting?
Well, we have a standing gun policy issue that we adopted a few years ago at Unidos U.S., and that is in support of universal background checks, a ban on assault weapons, restrictions on the acquisition of firearms and ammunition that's consistent with the protection of the civil rights of all Americans, and the real need to collect data, collection and analysis of data related to gun violence to understand the causes and develop the best prevention strategies. But what I would say is that we also have seen in our polling among Latinos that the issue of guns rose and broke into the top five of issues, and that had never happened before. But post El Paso, guns as an issue has risen to fourth place as one of the most important issues that Latinos are concerned about. And 87% of our community believe racism against Latinos and immigrants is a problem. 78% are very frustrated by Trump's attacks and fear it will get worse. And we see that correlation between the concern around gun violence and the racist rhetoric that is used to target our community. And that is a huge concern.
Bob Moore, President and CEO of El Paso Matters. When you were covering the just aftermath of the shooting a year ago in El Paso, there seemed to be a lack of interest in talking about the manifesto that the shooter wrote, and more of an interest in trying to talk about coming up with some mental health solutions. And you asked a question in a press conference to a Representative Veronica Escobar, and I'm going to play her response.
So the question about the manifesto and this emerging narrative that we're seeing throughout our country as to domestic terrorism, which is, you know, and obviously I want to say we don't know. We have to allow the investigation to continue. I respect the process very much so. But without regard to this particular instance, not speaking about this particular instance, which is still under investigation, but the manifesto narrative is fueled by hate, and it's fueled by racism and bigotry and division.
So, Bob Moore, did it seem like at the time when you were covering this that there was a deliberate attempt by those in power in Texas to play down the manifesto and say, oh, that's just the writings of a crazy person, let's deal with mental health, but actually there's a lot there that needs to be looked at?
So to put that in context, I think it's important to understand this was at a press conference at 5:30 on August 3rd. So about 7 hours or so after the shooting, and I want to be very specific that we name names here. Governor Abbott came to El Paso, which obviously he should have. He's the governor, and a massive tragedy had occurred in his state. So he arrives, he participates in that press conference along with four other men seated at a table. And it was Governor Abbott who went on at some length about mass shootings and mental health, which is something he's talked about at repeated mass killings in Texas. And what was concerning to me as I watched the press conference unfold is that literally no one was talking about what had happened here, because we all knew what the manifesto said. This was an act not just of racism, but an act that targeted Latinos and that targeted immigrants. And there was, I think, an initial discomfort to talk about that. That changed in the coming days. But obviously what was happening is the rhetoric in that manifesto was not unfamiliar rhetoric. As Janet Merguia has said, it's rhetoric that the president has used. It's rhetoric that Governor Abbott to some degree has also employed, but that Lieutenant Governor Patrick and other Republican leaders have definitely employed to demonize the border, to describe immigration as an invasion. So I think that's why there was this real discomfort initially to talk about it. We did talk about it in coming days and have proceeded to do absolutely nothing as a country except allow the COVID-19 pandemic to essentially put into place what the gunmen wanted, which was an end to asylum at the southern border. So when we talk about outcomes of the shooting, I think we have to remember that what has played out in the year since is that the gunman has sort of gotten his fondest wish.
And it's interesting that we keep talking about the gunman. We don't want to say his name. Is that something that I've said his name, but I don't make a big deal about it. I don't want to make him a billboard or a martyr or anything. Where are you with that, Bob?
I have no need to have his name in my mouth. It doesn't accomplish anything. His name is well known. I would rather talk about the names of the victims, and I would rather talk about El Paso, because that's what's really important.
And Deborah Zulaga, the CEO of the United Way of El Paso, how do you help people move away from the real thing of the manifesto and that expression of hate and move towards healing and love and compassion?
So it's going to be different for every single person. So the role of the Family Resiliency Center, El Paso United Family Resiliency Center, is to just identify different ways individually for how people move towards healing and towards I don't want to say resiliency center, resiliency in the sense that we are already a resilient community. We have that kind of baked into our history and into who we are as El Pasoans and who we are as a community. So, but it is about how. So our role is really to help individuals and a community as a whole to do that, and it's going to be different and unique for every person and every group. But at the heart of what it is, it's about saying we care. It's about saying we have resources here to help you. It's about saying we know the truth about our community, and it's really more about just being who we are, strong El Pasoans, resilient El Pasoans.
And you do that while also reminding people that there are individuals in the United States who have access to weapons of war, who are online, who are getting these scripts about how to hate and how to and focusing that hate through violence at their own community. I mean, we can't ignore that, right?
So, you know, I don't, it's not our intent to ignore it, but it is not the focus of El Paso United. Our focus of El Paso United is about services. It's about resources. It's about case management. It's about, you know, serving our community in the health and human services aspect of their healing.
All right. We're taking a break. We're talking about 1 year after the El Paso shooting. What lessons have we learned? Governor Greg Abbott formed a domestic terrorism task force in the wake of the El Paso shooting. What have they been doing in these last 12 months? Have they actually done anything to make it safer for people in the state of Texas? Also, it wasn't that long after El Paso shooting. It was on August 31st. There was another shooting in Midland, Odessa, where 8 people were killed on a rampage. And it seems like that incident actually sort of magnified what happened in El Paso. It echoed that. And what more can we think about that? This is the number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, El Paso, 1 year later. You can call in, tell us what you remember about the shooting. How did it impact you? I mean, here in San Antonio, hundreds of miles away, and still it echoed here. It was felt here. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Bob Moore, president and CEO of the news outlet in El Paso, El Paso Matters. What about this domestic terrorism task force that was formed by Governor Abbott in the wake of the El Paso shooting? What have they been doing?
Who knows? Haven't really seen much out of that. And to be fair, COVID-19 obviously disrupted a lot of things. You know, the idea was maybe to bring some legislation forward for the 2021 session. We'll see what happens. But obviously, COVID-19 is going to continue to overwhelm the discussions in that session.
It should be mentioned that Latinos have been disproportionately affected by the coronavirus and have been hospitalized at a rate 4 times higher than white Americans, according to the Center for Disease Prevention, Control and Prevention. Hispanic Texans make up 40% of the state's population, but 48% of the state's confirmed COVID-19 deaths, according to the Department of State Health Services data. So this is a crisis that is really hitting our Latino community, and it seems to be a compounding where we are right now. And I want to go back to Janet Murguia with Unidos US to talk about that. I mean, how does the COVID-19 situation weigh with you guys?
Sure. I mean, as I look at this 1 year later, I do believe that President Trump has doubled down on his rhetoric. Seems to have expanded that. I haven't heard a check on that from Republican leaders, but I think more interestingly and importantly is that the indifference to the loss of life in El Paso was a foreshadowing by the president of his indifference to now the numbers that you just talked about in Texas, across the country, 150,000 Americans have lost their lives to COVID-19, and many of whom might have been spared this had the president not completely and willfully botched our country's pandemic response. And I don't believe that Governor Abbott has responded as responsibly as he could. For us, we're seeing this brutal impact in our community, reflecting this indifference and also decades of systemic inequalities. I mean, the 4 counties across the valley in Texas on the border have 1.5 I think it's 1.3 million residents, but there's not one public hospital. Two-thirds of those people are uninsured. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that there is a need to really think about why is it that this disproportionate impact has hit our communities. And in addition to either indifference or what some have viewed as a lack of care for our community in this space, we need to really advocate for leaders who are going to understand that not only do we have to address COVID-19 in the moment, make sure that we have a clear strategy and resources directed to those who are suffering, but we need to really look long term at how do we address those underlying systemic inequalities. Why is it that there's not a public hospital there? Why do we still have a shortage of physicians? And why are so many of these folks still uninsured? And I think that there's a lot of work, a lot of layers there, but we have to address those as we look at what's happening in not just El Paso, but across the Texas border right now, and seeing this impact disproportionately on Latinos.
And so Deborah Zuloaga with the United Way of El Paso County, 60% of those without health insurance in Texas are Latino. This is also something that you're dealing with the United Way?
Yes. Yeah, we certainly, I mean, one of our areas of priority is health and especially access to health. And we actually, the United Way has led the coalition, Enroll El Paso Coalition, which is the community-wide focus on increasing enrollment in the Affordable Care Act for since 2013. So, you know, I agree. I think one of the things that we have seen, especially here in El Paso, is that the most vulnerable the most economically disadvantaged are those that have been impacted by COVID-19. And it is, I think, in many ways, just kind of pulled the curtain back on what we've known all along, especially here in El Paso, is the economic inequality and the health disparities affect everything in our community. And we're especially challenged here in El Paso because from the social service perspectives, from the agencies and the health and social service agencies, we don't have the resources that other larger communities have in terms of donors and in terms of funding. So we are doing even more with less. And again, it just goes back to the resiliency of this community that we're able to do what we can do with such very limited resources.
Now let's go back to the phones. Shannon is on the hold, and let's see here. Shannon, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'm just perplexed as to why everything is stemming from the rhetoric of the president when most of this stuff is supposed to be taken care of at a local level.
What do you mean?
There's very limited responsibility for the president of the United States to take care of local politics and community centers and all those types of things. But yet we're saying because of his rhetoric, we're having these mass shootings. I don't understand that. That doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. Shannon, thank you for calling. I appreciate that. Bob Moore, president and CEO of El Paso Matters, if you could just sort of react to what Shannon's telling us.
Sure, and I understand the sentiment, but immigration is a federal policy. Guns are, in large part, a federal policy, although the National Rifle Association has sort of prevented any federal involvement. And obviously, racism starts with the individual and spreads outward, but there's no question that the president's rhetoric referring to human beings trying to seek asylum as invaders of the United States and referring to Mexicans as rapists and murderers, it has clearly set the stage and emboldened racists in a way that no president has in generations. And so, you know, the president has staked out his positions. I don't see any value in pretending that either he hasn't staked out those positions or that those positions have no influence on individuals.
The shooting happened in El Paso a year ago. There's also the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh that targeted Jewish Americans. And in March a year ago, there was the shooting in San Diego at the synagogue that Oscar Stewart managed to stop before one person was killed. So there's a lot of these. It's not just one or two. It happens all the time, it seems like. And the rhetoric is you can you draw a direct line to the rhetoric, Janet Merguia?
Oh, I think so. I think we saw that clearly when you look at the Shooter's Manifesto and echoing those terms. And then again, seeing that the president himself has doubled down on the use of some of that rhetoric and targeting not just immigrants, but Hispanics and Latinos. A poll done by Univision in 2019, late last year, showed that 86% of Latinos fear that there will be another mass shooting based on ethnic hatred. When you see that rhetoric, bigoted, racist rhetoric, not just promoted by our president, but echoed by shooters who are now in the court process for these massive shootings, the largest deadly assault on Latinos in the country, it's hard not to draw the line. You have to see that. And the president needs to assume some responsibility for it, but he didn't even acknowledge that it was the largest, deadliest shooting of Latinos in the country. And he has yet to date to really pull back on this stoking of fear and demonization of not just immigrants, but of Hispanics and Latinos. And so deadly words have deadly consequences. And we have to make sure that people choose their words correctly. And again, we as a Latino community.
I want to try and get one last caller. I'm sorry to cut you off. I want to try this really quick. And Jay, we're really, really short on time. I'll give you like 45 seconds.
Okay. I just wanted to say that words matter. And President Trump bears a responsibility for the anti-immigrant rhetoric that he. Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
That he spews during the press conferences, and people are in denial if they don't recognize that. That's hate language.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for calling, and I'm glad we're able to squeeze you in. And so really, I have like a minute left in the program. Deborah Zuluaga with the United Way of El Paso, where do you want the commemoration to be next year? What's it going to be like? Really quickly, 30 seconds.
So we certainly are hoping, I think part of healing is also the ability to embrace, to be together, having a socially distanced healing was difficult because it doesn't go to the core of who we are, which is to comfort each other during difficult times. So, it is our intent next year to make it a more personal, more physically connected. This year was very socially distanced, people staying in their cars, driving through luminarias. We're really hoping to make it a lot more reflective of our community and Hispanic culture of caring and holding each other close.
All right, Deborah Zuluaga, the CEO of the United Way of El Paso County, Bob Moore, President and CEO of El Paso Matters, and Janet Merguia, the President and CEO of Unidos U.S. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for joining us.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Ruben Garcia and Kathleen Creedon. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.